Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our guest today is our own political columnist for the Bulwark, Amanda Carpenter, who was also a CNN contributor and the author of an evergreen book, Gaslighting America. Boy, did you know when you wrote this, by the way, Amanda, that gaslighting would become like the thing in American politics?
I was afraid it would. and sadly, my predictions have come true. Just what's different now is that Trump has the full force of the federal government helping him gaslight America. And just realizing how powerful that is and the effect it's not only having on the Republican Party, but the country, the future of campaigning, it's a lot to grapple with.
It is. And so that's just try to capture the moment, which is always difficult these days. We have a new report in that another 1.5 million Americans have filed for unemployment insurance. So apparently it's not morning in America again right now. We're also getting indications that the coronavirus, which I thought was last month's news, is in fact coming back. We have spikes in various states, you're a media observer. How weird it was when we hit 100,000 deaths in the coronavirus, and then it was like the next day it was like, okay, that's the end of that season. Now in season three, it's over. We'd forgotten about it, and so it feels weird that now it's like, hey, meanwhile, back here in the real world, these cases are spiking. And you just know that the federal government, that Trump is going to be locked into a narrative that's going to prevent us from addressing this if it comes roaring back in any way.
Yeah, watching the death cases creep up was alarming. Going past the 100,000 mark was scary. But yesterday, there was a reporter for Bloomberg News who tweeted, Trump is bringing back the rallies. And she said, Trump's first post-coronavirus rally will be scheduled, da-da-da-da-da. And I just thought to myself, this is a smart reporter. Post-coronavirus?
It's either a lie
or wildly optimistic, or someone's just eager to get to the campaign season and that sort of reporting. But we're not anywhere near post-coronavirus. And the fact that anyone writes that, it's not just head-scratching, it's sickening.
It is strange. And so we find ourselves also, while all of this is going on, the president of the United States thinks he's got another wedge issue. He's doubling down on, of all the issues in the world, to say that I am absolutely going to oppose renaming any of these U.S. military bases that honor Southern Confederate generals. He said, let me just read his tweets because I think they're interesting. It has been suggested that we should rename as many as 10 of our legendary military bases, such as Fort Bragg in North Carolina, Fort Hood in Texas, Fort Benning in Georgia. These monumental and very powerful bases have become part of a great American heritage. Random capitalizations here. History of winning, victory, and freedom. Could you just stop here? I mean, they're all named after generals who lost. They lost the Civil War. And he says, our history as the greatest nation in the world will not be tampered with. Respect our military. So Donald Trump deciding that he's going to die on the hill of military installations named after Confederate generals. Help me with this, Amanda.
I think Trump boxed himself into the position of defending any kind of Confederate memorial with Charlottesville. Of course, this just doesn't make any sense. I mean, isn't Donald Trump the one that doesn't like people who are captured, people who lost? I think we all can recognize that there was a time in American history where we wanted the North and South to come together, and this is their way of sort of doing that, putting up, naming Confederate generals. But in my mind, aren't we past that by now? Hasn't the nation healed somewhat? And it's so strange to me. I'm not a member of the military. My brother served in the Marine Corps. I'm not especially close to military culture. But there were two sides in this war. One side that did not want to be a part of America, that tried to secede, that fought a war to break apart from it. and the other half that fought for the United States of America. So yes, let's rename it. We have lots more generals, people that served in Afghanistan and the rest, and there's people a lot smarter than me on this issue, like General Petraeus, who has even written that it doesn't really make sense why we've done this. And so, yeah, we can move on. But Donald Trump isn't really a thinker about this. I think he looks at this in terms of who are my people. He saw good people on both sides in Charlottesville because the people marching to protect that Confederate memorial were his people. You can see that in the people waving the Confederate flag at his rallies, putting it in their yards alongside, you know, the Trump 2020 flag, which is something I see quite frequently where I live. And so I think he's just boxed in there.
Well, again, he, of course, it's also sort of his reptilian instinct here. So on this issue of the naming the forts, I have to admit, I've paid no attention to this issue at all. I really haven't. So when I read this in the New York Times yesterday, I thought, hey, this is really an interesting question. So you remember how the Civil War began, right? The firing on Fort Sumter. This was, you know, April 11th, 1861. And the commander of the Confederate forces at the time was General Beauregard, Pierre Beauregard. And he demanded that Major Anderson of the Union Army surrender Fort Sumter in South Carolina. Anderson, who is in the U.S. Army, refused. Beauregard then opened fire, shot at the U.S. military. Civil war ensued. Today, Beauregard has an army base in Louisiana named after him. Anderson does not. Now, which side of the divide do you want to be on that debate right now? So this is one where,
it's a curious question. Why aren't there more Yankee memorials?
Well, it's fascinating.
Seriously.
You know, how do you name a U.S. military base after someone who killed members of the U.S. military? Okay, so here's my thing about this, Amanda, because I think, and this is grudging, that Trump has really always had this, and I write this in my newsletter today, this reptilian instinct for tapping into this zeitgeist. I mean, he's crude, he's dumb and everything, but he does have this sort of had this sort of sense of these darker impulses. So he was able to exploit these dormant frustrations and fears, you know, and he rode that to the White House, right? And he hopes that, and he obviously thinks that it's going to work for him again. So we're getting the racial anxiety, patriotism, law and order, caravans, rapist immigrants, deep state, Antifa, all of that stuff. But I got to get this. I really had the sense yesterday that he's lost the narrative, that he's not reading the room. And that he may actually be losing the cultural war, because you look what's happening around the country. Look at public opinion. Look at this dramatic shift in the numbers, people reacting to even Black Lives Matter, the support for the protests. And this is the day that he chooses to double down on the Confederacy. And it's the same day that NASCAR bans the Confederate flag. I mean, these are his people, right, Amanda? I mean, this is the home country.
Well, it makes me remember the Central Park Five. I mean, he's been playing the race card in a terrible way for a long time.
And he can't stop.
He can't stop. It's always worked for him, right? And he thinks it's going to work for him again. I mean, about it. Central Park Five, he took out ads in the New York newspaper calling for the death penalty for these guys. They were cleared with DNA evidence. And even when he was asked about this, and I can't remember if it was 2014 or 2015, he said, well, you know, there was some stuff about them. He never apologized. And he wanted these people to die and never retracted what he said.
Well, this is one of the things about Donald Trump is he really doesn't change. He may have these instincts, but he doesn't change. It's like it's not even a playbook. It's sort of like the fixation. And he just assumes that it's going to play the same way that it used to. And of course, it's not 1968 anymore. So I thought the NASCAR thing was a very, very interesting tell that they made that decision. And then also the NFL. And this is, you know, it was back in September 2017. He decided he'd found this fantastic wedge issue. You know, the NFL players who knelt in protest. Remember, he was basically saying, you know, I would like these NFL owners to fire these sons of bitches, get them off the field. And he thought this was a great issue. In fact, they you know, when they sent Pence to one of the games and he swarmed out and everything. In that book, Team of Vipers, which is not a great book, but it's got this anecdote where he's relishing the fight. The Democrats, you watch, they're going to nominate a kneeler, Trump. He quotes Trump as saying, 2020 will be fun. That I can tell you, a lot of fun. The kneelers, just watch. So he still thinks, like up till now, he lashed out at Roger Goodell, that going after black players who kneel is going to be a great issue for him. And I wonder, again, if he's reading the room. Because it worked for him in firing up his base and driving the wedge. But I don't think it's going to play the same way this fall.
No, we've learned a lot more about what police brutality means. And when Trump got into this, I mean, Colin Kaepernick was the poster boy for it, so to speak. And I think he made the mistake of wearing those socks with
very bad
cops depicted as pigs. And so that wasn't a good opening starter for that conversation. But now we've seen the videos. We see this as a repeated thing. And so there's the knowledge like, okay, there is something there now. And you may not have agreed with how Kaepernick started that conversation. And I think he made a lot of mistakes along the way. It was still a conversation that needed to be had. And people forced that conversation right into Lafayette Square.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the socks, because I think, and I remember when this happened, it was one of those things where, okay, you're not being respectful here if you wear pig socks. And I think he wore a t-shirt at one point, but he tried to explain at the time, and I'm going to confess here that I completely tuned him out on this, that he had been talking to a friend of his who was in the military, who told him that kneeling was an act of respect. It was not an act of disrespect. And we think of kneeling in any other context, it is an act of respect. And I think people tuned him out. And a lot of it had to do with the personality of Colin Kaepernick. Let's leave that aside. But I think that this fall, if you have players who kneel and they explain it in that context, people are not going to tune that out. They are going to pay attention to this. And so Donald Trump, who thinks he's got the magic bullet going after the kneelers, again, I think he's tone deaf on this one. I think his instincts are not the asset that he imagines. And so what he's going to do is, of course, he's going to double down on all the stuff he does. He's going to have the rallies, as you mentioned. And you know what that's going to be like. There's not going to be a lot of healing and conciliation or reaching out to independents.
One thing that Donald Trump had going for him when the whole kneeling debate started is that it became a form of disrespect somehow towards the military. Yeah. I'm still not totally sure how that happened, except for, you know, the NFL is a big proponent of the military. They do flyovers during the Star Spangled Banner. Therefore, somehow you shouldn't kneel there. I'm not sure how that happened. But what has changed since then is that you have many well-respected members of the military saying, you know, what Donald Trump is doing to these protesters is wrong in spectacular fashion. You know, letters from Mattis. I mean, how many signatories to letters have we seen fluttering around in protests to how Donald Trump used force to clear people who were making the same point that Colin Kaepernick was? So I think that's changed.
It has changed. So since you wrote the book on gaslighting, I have to admit that I still find it breathtaking that the president of the United States, in the midst of these crises, facing an uphill fight for reelection, decides to tweet out this weird half-assed conspiracy theory about the 75-year-old man in Buffalo. Is this the kind of thing that you were writing about that you describe as gaslighting?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump is really only good at one thing. And when I talk about gaslighting, it's not just him telling a lie. It's inventing a whole narrative to smear people, to take them down and declare victory. I mean, this is, in a nutshell, what he did to this elderly protester up in Buffalo. So the guy gets knocked out. And while he's in the hospital, in critical condition, unable to respond, maybe not even aware of what's happening, Donald Trump decides to post a tweet depicting him as some member of Antifa conducting black ops based on some conspiracy theory floating around the internet in OANN. And what's funny about Trump is that he never completely invents it. It's always something that's percolating out there. And so he picked it up from there and shoved it into the mainstream.
Just asking questions. But he's just asking questions.
Oh, and his White House press secretary.
Because it's out there. Yeah.
And that was stunning. You know, so Donald Trump now has the whole government helping him do this. And we saw that play out in the White House briefing room. And I really wish people would quit saying that Kayleigh McEnany is somehow smart. Someone smart would not do this. You're talking about someone that was so desperate to be on TV that she styled herself into a puppet for Trump. Is it smart to throw yourself into taking a job that no one else who is qualified or experienced would want? Because everyone knows Trump makes people into fools. He uses them as puppets to deploy this madness, whether on television in any kind of form. And I just, you know, no one can be smart if they're dumb enough to do that.
But this is what she signed up for.
That's my point. Who would do this? How could you be so blind with ambition that you would deliberately raise your hand and say, yes, I want to be the 100th liar for Trump?
Well, you answered it. Blinded by ambition. That was. Do you remember? That was John Dean's book. Was Blind Ambition, when he explained how he got sucked into the Nixon White House. Is there a distinction, since you raised this? Because I must admit I'm fascinated by this notion, because I watch Kayleigh McEnany, and I'm going, we're supposed to think this is sort of like a really highly educated, very sophisticated mind. I don't quite get it. Is there a difference between smart and wise? I'm not trying to offer any defenses here or anything, but okay, let's say that she's bright, but utterly without conscience or judgment. Is there a word for that?
I've gotten to know her sort of through experiences. Being well spoken and being able to memorize arguments and prep well. Listen, anybody can be well spoken with practice. Anyone can be presentable with the right tools, but what is being displayed here is complete and utter moral bankruptcy and blind ambition. I just will never agree that that's wise or smart, because no, it's wrapped up in a package that looks nice.
Okay, so help me with this, because you actually have some insight into all of this. You know people like this, right? Because I do think that people outside the media, outside of politics, are wondering, why would someone do all of this? So had you been on TV with her? Had you been in green rooms with her? Or people like her?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time without, you know, we've both been through the media. And in the summer of 2016, there was a shortage, as we all know, of people willing to publicly defend Trump. And all across the media, there's people that had to fit into that box. Kayleigh wasn't one of those people originally. It's been in the ads that people are making. We all know she bashed Trump, saying he wasn't authentic and all the rest. But there was a slot if you were willing to turn yourself into a Trump puppet. And she threw herself into that to the max degree. And, you know, it's her choice. You know, she volunteered for it. I don't know who would look at that scenario and say, this is a good decision, unless you're just completely and utterly blind with ambition. And you say, wow, if I can get these spots, then I'll be important. Then I'll be powerful now, without looking at the steps and how you had to sacrifice your conscience all along the way to get there. I mean, I look at it's so sad to me to watch somebody get contorted like this.
So I want to flip that narrative around a little bit, because you said something that's very interesting, and I think that's important for people to understand, is that there was a decision on the part of some folks in the media, across the board in the media, to say that, okay, we'll put you on if you play this particular role. So the incentive structure was created in a sense by the media, saying, we're looking for people who will carry water for Donald Trump, which is why you got your Jeffrey Lords, why certain people who would never have been on television in a million years, nobody would have cared about their opinion, suddenly became ubiquitous because they would fill that slot. So to a certain extent, the media sort of dangled out the hook with the worm on it, right?
Well, part of it was they wanted to provide balance.
Yeah.
Right. In the programming. And Donald Trump, against everybody's expectations, he became a prominent figure and they needed people to balance that out. But I think there's questions about how much coverage was surrendered over to that rather than being in control of the political narrative themselves. But everybody was so shell-shocked and concerned about being accused of bias and everything else. I think the answer just became, well, we'll just put, a Trump person up there at all times so we can't be accused of bias.
So that you would get this phenomenon that people have described in the past of somebody who would go on one of the three cable channels and they would, carry water for Trump and then would, pull out the earpiece afterwards and said, oh, I need to go take a shower, because they understood they were actually playing a role. It wasn't sincere. It was completely transactional on everybody's part. And Kayleigh is kind of a creature of all of that.
I never saw that. I've heard stories about it.
Yeah, I've heard the stories too.
I did not see that.
So I'm not to dwell on Kayleigh, but it really was extraordinary that she decided that she was going to defend the utterly indefensible. Do you notice that most people in Trump world just ran for the tall grass on this one? That almost,
because they're smarter, at least they may be craven and only concerned about their own personal, livelihoods. But yeah, who would run to the microphone on this issue in this environment?
Yeah, there are, of course, going to be some folks in the far reaches, but most of the anti-Trump folks observe strategic silence. And then within, they'll wait a couple of hours and then they'll find somebody in the media who said something ridiculous and they'll attack the critics of Trump, or they'll just simply move on. The point I tried to make yesterday in a piece I wrote, though, is that to a certain extent, the fact that he tweets these things has become kind of an excuse for people to trivialize them when it ought not to be, because the problem is not the tweet at all. It is the man. Tweets tell us who Donald Trump is, and we need to have context of this. I mean, I think it was Christian Schneider wrote a good piece for us saying that in order to defend Trump or rationalize Trump, you have to not put anything in context. You have to treat each individual thing in complete isolation, because if you step back and you look at the pattern, you go, oh, my God, this man, he's nuts. He's either nuts or deeply sociopathic. But what that scene, what did you think of that scene of all of the senators who just sort of marched by and I didn't see the tweet. I'm not going to look at it. Would you like to read the tweet? No, I don't even want to know. They don't want to even address it. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to comment on it. So to be a Republican senator these days, you have to have your head up your new, your almost 24/7 now.
It's remarkable to me how long elected Republicans have gotten away with sort of saying, well, I'm not going to respond to the tweets, or going to the media and say, I wish he wouldn't tweet. I privately advised him to tone his tweets down. You cannot separate Trump from his tweets.
Right.
He is the tweets. The tweets are Trump in pure, unadulterated form. But even more so, what kind of representative are you when you think that you can encase yourself in some kind of soundproof, internet-proof bubble and act like the tweets aren't there when he broadcasts these messages to millions and millions and millions of people? How can you, so you're just not supposed to respond to that, but yet everyone else has to live with Trump's tweets and hear about them and try to analyze them, but you as an elected official are somehow immune from that? I mean, that's crazy. And yeah, I wish the follow-on question would be, Manu and other reporters, they've been, printing out the tweets, so they can't say I haven't seen them. But then they say, oh, well, I just don't want to talk about it. There needs to be a follow-up question. So you don't think what the president says is important anymore? I'd like to hear the answer to that question.
So what is the mood among Republicans right now? I mean, I have to admit, I kind of laughed at the headline in the Washington Post. Republicans really, really now concerned about the consequences of having a ticket led by Donald Trump. Well, as if only you had been warned, people. So now they're starting to realize that they have a problem. How deep is the anxiety?
Well, they knew they had a problem. They just didn't think it would affect them. there was a story in the Washington Post yesterday, and I'm sure you probably read it too, about how that's one you're probably referencing, where Republicans are worried. And one of the quotes, you know, anonymously from some, you know, high level advisor says they're in a state of grieving. Well, I mean, sorry, guys, you lost your souls a long time ago and now you're sad. And but what is just stunning to me is that they still act like, well, there's just not anything we can do about it. We're just going to have to shut up and ride this out. We're prisoners on the boat. We'll see what happens. Are you kidding me? I mean, at least now you're not willing to fight for your own survival and try to make a break with this. I mean, who up for election right now or thinking about running in 2024 is looking at this dumpster fire of Trump polling and says, you know what, I need to wait this out and stay in Trump's good graces so I can inherit his mantle. Even politically speaking, isn't there anyone who would want to take a risk right now and say, you know, I don't agree with this and try to chart the foundations for a new path forward? Not only does that seem to be the right thing to do, but the path with the most political upside long term.
So there's discussion on both in both houses, on both sides of the aisle, about the possibility of significant police reform. There was some speculation that Trump himself was working on an executive order that would be able to put him in a different light, that he would, in fact, address all of this. So in normal conventional terms, this is a moment where you might have some progress on doing something about police violence. But give me your sense of how this, in fact, will play out as the campaign's heating up with the Trump effect. I guess I always go into this extremely skeptical that Trump will ever want to solve this problem. I'm saying sometimes they do, but we'll solve this problem that he sees as a cudgel.
Yeah, I'll tell you how.
Yeah, so how's it going to play out?
Here's what I predict is going to happen. Donald Trump will write some kind of window dressing, ineffective, do nothing executive order, maybe with the input of, you know, the only Black Republican senator, Tim Scott, on the margins, so he can go to a rally and say there was a problem and I solved it while everyone waves a Confederate flag. That's what I see playing out.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to persuade anyone because whatever he says, and I could certainly imagine him also having a press conference where he reads statements in which all the words show that he gets it and he's serious about it. But it doesn't matter what he says, because give it a minute, give it a few days, he will tweet out something that will erase any possible goodwill that would have been created. But I think your analysis is probably right. By the way, we started this podcast by talking about the fact that amazingly the coronavirus is not gone, and I'm just looking at a new headline while you and I are speaking, and of course people will be listening to this later. That the Dow slid 900 points on fears of coronavirus resurgence and more economic pain, which is this moment where it's like, really, did we really think we were just going to turn the page on this, that it was just going to go away? You know,
I'm just preparing myself for wild swings with the economy, with predictions for coronavirus, with whether we're going to get a vaccine, whether we can reopen or not. We're in for a roller coaster ride. There's going to be no clear answers. It's going to go up and down and left and right, and just buckle up.
Well, and you know what Trump is going to do? He will blame any resurgence on the protests.
Absolutely.
And you know what? I have to tell you, I have real mixed feelings about all of this. I mean, I think the protests are quite moving, but I also understand the critics who say, wait. So we can't go to church. We can't have summer camp for our kids. And the same people that are, you know, have shut down much of the country are applauding this quote unquote lack of social distancing. Okay, don't beat me up. I know that a lot of people wear masks, but I can also see the pictures. A lot of people don't wear masks. When there were conservative groups that protested in, say, Michigan, people were talking about what a threat to public health this was. So again, this is going to get messy here. But you know that what Trump's going to do is say, this is not my fault. And he's going to try to turn this to turn public opinion against the protests, right?
Yeah, but then he'd have to believe that coronavirus is actually a threat. So that gets difficult.
Yeah.
Here's what I think the real misstep was. I think public health officials, those inside the Trump administration and out, made two critical missteps. The first was saying that people didn't have to buy and wear masks. That was number one. The second one is public health officials not vociferously warning about the coronavirus threat in these protests. You know, you've kind of seen some people say, well, if you're going to go out, just wear your mask. Well, no, that is not fair. But I also have a lot of frustration with people on the right who do make the argument that, well, I guess it's okay if they can protest, I can go to church. Well, you could go to church if you were willing to risk getting arrested and violating all the public health rules like the protesters were. You could do that. Just like, as you pointed out, the people that went to the capitals in Michigan, you could do that if you want to risk, you know, being arrested like everyone else. I don't want to take those risks.
Yeah.
But no matter where you fall and what you want to do and how you want to live your life, coronavirus is out there. People are dead. More people are going to die. I am very worried about these Trump rallies. I mean, if you look at the history of the 1918 pandemic, everybody got it from that war bonds parade in Philadelphia. I mean, it's just like history is repeating itself.
Very much so. And people, it's worth reminding people who are thinking, well, it's outdoors, it can't have any effect. So I think you put your finger on why I don't think it's going to be effective to blame the protests for the return of the coronavirus, because what's the other big initiative? Trump is bringing back his MAGA rallies. And so there's a couple of PR people who push out just, you know, Trumpist stuff. And right next to, in my email box, right next to news alert, Dow slides 900 points and fears of coronavirus resurgence, literally right next to it, there's an email, guest available, the Trump MAGA rallies are back, exclamation point. Does Joe Biden have anything that compete? And then all in caps, he's back, Trump to hold campaign rally next week in Oklahoma. So
that swing state of Oklahoma.
What's that about, do you think?
I think they needed to find a place where people were willing to give Trump the rally that would make him feel all warm and fuzzy inside. It's not about political strategy at all. It's about his feelings.
So the convention, Republican convention, moving from Charlotte to Jacksonville, Florida. Same thing. Why Jacksonville, Florida? Because you finally found a governor and the local officials that are going, yeah, you know, LOL, whatever.
Why not?
Just
why not?
So you're doing a piece for The Bulwark on Orange Man Bad.
Yes, it's a follow-on to, it's actually funny, when Tim Miller last month wrote a piece, actually, Orange Man is Bad, and I had emailed him like a week before saying, hey, Tim, I have an idea for a piece. Would it be stupid if I wrote 100 reasons why Orange Man is Bad? And he was kind of like, LOL, let me send you my Google Doc. I'm already writing that piece. I'm like, okay. But then after what happened in Lafayette Square, I said, you know what? I do want to revisit this because it is hard to explain when the people who support Trump throw out this orange man bad as a juvenile retort to sort of dismiss your very real and legitimate concerns about why he is bad. It's frustrating because it's hard to succinctly explain why. And so I figured, like, okay, I'm going to make a list. It actually was hard to limit it to 100.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
I had to fold, you know, all the times he's called women who accuse him of sexual assault liars, and et cetera. Like, that's just one category on the list. And you kind of forget about things that happened, such as him overseeing the largest government shutdown in history. I completely forgot that happened. I had 100 reasons I had to go back and, oh, yeah, that happened. And, oh, yeah, the reason why it happened is that he was trying to get funding for the southern border wall that he said Mexico was going to pay for. You know, the amnesia with the Trump era is real.
It's hard to keep up. We've talked about this again and again. So just so for listeners to this, to understand what the meme is, Orange Man Bad, it's what the anti-Trumpers have come up with in order not to defend Trump, but just to say, anytime there's a criticism of Trump, it's like, oh, you people again, that's all you ever say is Orange Man Bad, as if the criticisms of Trump are somehow not serious, not substantive. It's just this sort of, crude dislike of the president. So the term Orange Man Bad was created by Trump apologists to dismiss criticism of Trump, correct?
Correct. And the answer is he is bad, right. And Amanda Carpenter has 100 reasons why.
Okay, so like, how did you order them? I mean, what are the first 10?
I had to do it by chronology because trying to put it in categories was difficult because I didn't want to say like, oh, you know, have it in some kind of ranking where his racist stuff is somehow worse or better than him standing with dictators. Like, it's all pretty bad. It's all kind of gets why he shouldn't be president. So yeah, the first couple, you know, losing $1 billion in business loans over a decade, promoting birtherism for 4 years, announcing his presidential campaign by describing America as a dumping ground for other people's problems. You know, John McCain, not a war hero. I'm just scrolling through it, saying Judge Curiel is not fit to rule in a lawsuit because of his Mexican heritage, calling on Russia to hack and release Hillary Clinton's emails, hyping claims of unfounded election, Muslim ban, having sensitive talks about North Korea's ballistic missile launch on the patio of Mar-a-Lago.
I'm almost sensing a pattern here. I'm sensing a pattern. And this again goes back to the how you have to think of Donald Trump out of context. Otherwise, you can't handle it. You know, how do you go, okay, but all of this is true, but we get our federal judges and our regulation. You have to either engage in very selective understanding of all of this, complete amnesia, or just taking everything, you know, taking it one tweet at a time, right? Because I'm guessing that as you read through this, you go, oh my God, I forgot about this. I forgot about this. I forgot about this. And a reminder, Donald Trump is exactly who everybody thought he was, right? I mean, there's nothing surprising.
It's worse maybe because people thought he'd get better.
Did they really?
I mean,
they told themselves that.
I thought in the first couple weeks, you know, I will say before, during the transition period, that surely there was a shot at him coming into office and sort of toning it down, still saying inflammatory things, but, you know, maybe, you know, I was willing to give it the benefit of the doubt in the beginning. I was never going to support him 100%, but of course I had to be like, okay, let's hope it gets better. But, you know, that was all gone with the American Carnage speech and Sean Spicer being wound up to lie about the inauguration crowd sizes as the first official act. So poof.
Yeah, it was day one that we started off with all of that. Now I have to admit that because I did suffer from Trump derangement syndrome. I probably suffered from Trump derangement syndrome going back to 2015, never really got over it. Never had any moments of doubt. Although, by the way, speaking of things that we didn't get, I admitted in my newsletter yesterday when we were watching Marco Rubio taking a dive on this whole gaslighting about the man in Buffalo, that I was pretty much all in for Marco Rubio in 2015. And people were going, well, what were you thinking of? And I said, look, remember, he was on the cover of Time magazine as the savior of the GOP. And I believe that shit. I'm sorry. I did. And it really does raise the question, you know, if somebody like a Marco Rubio had been elected president, would this weakness, these flaws in character, have become subsumed in his need to be presidential, or would they have manifested themselves? And I think we know what the answer. Well, you know,
I mean, I think Donald Trump just craters people to lows we never anticipated.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I'm not. It wouldn't have been this bad.
Well, no, It wouldn't have been this bad. But sooner or later, these things come out and. You know,
I mean, I witnessed Marco working in the Senate through the government shutdown, how, you know, my perspective, he wasn't that willing to stand with people like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and Rand Paul on the very hard questions. And he always tried to like hedge it a little bit. So I saw that up close early. So, you know, but he wasn't bad. I like Marco. I would have been happy with him as president. Like,
oh, I would have. Well, yeah, we would have been better off. And, you know, we have a different perspective on all this. But I also admitted that I'm less embarrassed about the fact that I have pictures of myself with Marco Rubio than the pictures with Ted Cruz. Now, you know, explain Ted Cruz.
I can't. I'm not associated. I haven't talked to anybody in that camp for a long time. I think Chip Roy, who is my former chief of staff in that office, is doing pretty good work as a congressman on the House side now. He's finding a way to move the ball on issues in a way that I think are good. But yeah, I see Cruz's tweets, and I honestly, I just have to say, you know, the office I worked in, that was a different time and place.
It does feel like a different time and place. And I know that there are people who say, well, you knew all this, you saw all this. And the answer is actually no.
No.
No. This was a different time. This was a different place. There were different issues, and there were different ways in which people manifested who they were. And I do think that there's, you know, there's not one static personality. We're not just one person and who goes through time. There, you know, everybody has different layers, right? Different potentials. You can go one direction or you can go another direction. You can appeal to your better angels, you know, or decide that, you know, this is something I want to stand on in principle. Or that same person can be the person who's cowering in the foxhole. And we can all be, you know, the hero can be the coward, right? I mean, it's one of the complicated things, but I wrestle with this. Some of the people that I work with very, very closely in Wisconsin, watching what they say and what they do. And I get a lot of flack for that. Well, you supported this person. Well, yeah, at that time I did, because I thought they were taking, they were right on this issue, and that they showed a great deal of character. And so when you watch the same people being on the wrong side of an issue and showing a complete lack of character, it's embarrassing, but maybe it's a reminder of the complexity of human nature. Hey, that got deep, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that was really deep.
That got deep.
Yeah, I think that's all right, but people change. Some people change with circumstances, and maybe you call that a lack of principle. I mean, maybe Cruz legitimately changed his mind about Trump and legitimately sees good in the judges, and has, you know, he's obviously made the calculation that he's going to stick his neck out when he thinks he can make a good argument. And I do think this explains a lot of Cruz. He prides himself on making good arguments. He's a competitive lawyer. And so when he sees the chance to do that for Trump, I think he makes the extra effort to do so. I mean, he's got a podcast called The Verdict, right? Like, yeah, he really went out there through impeachment, because I think that played to his ego a bit. But again, I'm not close to it. I'm looking at the people that I'm currently struggling with, to use a phrase, is Nikki Haley, because I so desperately want her still to be a person that leads us out of this. And when she posts these tweets about how she struggles with this or that, but she's so silent, strategically silent about other things. I mean, this is the woman that took down the Confederate flag in South Carolina. I want someone to have some moral clarity on these issues now, rather than just waiting to see where the chips fall after November. And so if I have any kind of, you know, grist in my heart right now, it's probably for her. And it's probably because she's one of the few female leaders I see being able to compete as a Republican on the national stage. And so what? She's going to get steamrolled by Mike Pompeo, who I think is probably the most natural inheritor of the Trump mantle at this point.
So this is interesting, because I focusing on Nikki, because I think part of your disappointment is, of course, the delta between her potential and the reality. It's that you expect more from her, because think of the contrast. This is interesting. Think of the kind of the Republican governor of South Carolina was the first one to take down the Confederate flag. And remember what a classy way she did it. She did it with dignity. She handled it as well as it could have been handled. It was a clear moral position. And think about a Republican Party headed by somebody capable of that versus the moment we're in right now. And so Nikki Haley is still the Nikki Haley who pulled down the Confederate flag, but she's still the Nikki Haley who is not going to allow any daylight between herself and Donald Trump. I don't envy them. I, you know what? You know, there's a big price to be paid for being any Trump Republican, but I do not envy any of those people at any moment.
No, she should have just gone to New Zealand or something for 4 years and just, you know, I'm out of this, I'm taking time off, and come back later. If you're going to try to parse this, I mean, we'll see. We'll see what she does. But she, we know, I mean, she took on, you know, the old boys in her state to ride the Tea Party wave and get into power. This is a woman who knows how to take risks and do it for the right things. And so I'd love to see more. I guess that's where I am.
Well, I also think that I'm surprised that more people have not taken that really excellent piece of advice you just had, that there are times when you are better off just going to New Zealand and keeping your mouth shut. I do think that, for example, Paul Ryan is much smarter to keep a very, very low profile than Scott Walker, who keeps tweeting inane things. I think that that's smart. I mean, as disappointing as Ryan is, and as much as I would love to see him speak up at a moment like this, I think he's read the room and he understands that at least you don't go out there and rationalize and suck up.
Well, I give Ryan credit. He tried, right?
He tried.
Right? I mean, he went out there and said, you know, this is textbook racism. I mean, he could have tried harder, but he tried.
He tried, and I think his fate is also an indication of what happened to the Republican Party. So what should we be watching over the next couple of days, Amanda? What are you focusing on? What are you obsessed about?
Well, qualified immunity, which is something, if you asked me 3 months ago what it was, I'd probably guess it was something about coronavirus testing for a vaccine. I'm kind of fascinated. Yeah. I don't understand. Why are conservatives supporting clear abuses of power by police officers? Why do they get extra protection when they clearly do harm to people? I don't understand why police officers, if they arrest somebody, they're somehow entitled to rough them up in the back of the police van and let them hit their head 100 times. Or if you're in the course of arresting someone and they pull out a knife out of their pocket to show you that they have a weapon, you can shoot them in the back 22 times, which is something that happened in Martinsburg, West Virginia, where a judge most recently ruled that, you know, we need to look at qualified immunity. And so this is just a subject I didn't know anything about. And it seems like the Cato Institute is the only organization maybe on the right libertarian side of things that has been really concerned about it. Although I did find in a court ruling that Justice Clarence Thomas said he'd be interested in looking at it if a better case presented itself. And one of the most recent cases that it was ruled on seems pretty juvenile in that a teenager was arrested for burping in class. And so people are looking at about whether the police could have arrested him. But there's a lot more cases. I mean, Black women getting arrested. There's one case where she had drugs. She had like a baggie of drugs in her mouth, which is bad, not good, should be arrested. But they choked her to death trying to get it out. I mean, all these excessive uses of force, which seem to happen all the time. I think conservatives would naturally want to look at that.
And I do think there are conservatives who have been willing to push back on the issue of qualified immunity. You mentioned the Cato Institute. I know that David French has written about this. But in the culture wars, unfortunately, I think that Trump is going to be pushing the Republican Party into being you either back the badge or you are backing Antifa. And by the way, I should throw this in because we've been talking about Donald Trump losing the culture war. And I've talked about this on the podcast several days. I continue to be amazed at the political ineptness of the folks who are pushing the defund police slogan, which is a gift to the Trump administration. Folks affiliated with Antifa in Seattle taking over part of the city, an autonomous zone, you know, a no-go zone for police. These things are really gifts for Donald Trump. This is exactly the way he wants to frame it. If the issue is, should we reorganize and rethink policing, the Democrats have a powerful issue. If it's defund policing, it is exactly what Donald Trump wants to talk about, exactly where he wants to be.
Yeah, and I don't understand. How did they paint that slogan on the streets of Washington, D.C. in front of the White House? I mean, I understand Black Lives Matter. Everybody thought that was a good idea. But somehow people were allowed to just paint the street with a giant slogan. And nobody I just want to look at how that happened, especially if the mayor doesn't stand by it. I mean, can I paint any slogan I want in the streets of DC? I mean, and also who painted it? Because all of the, you know, elected Democratic leadership, they're running away from this thing. They're saying we don't want to defund the police.
Right.
So who's spokesperson for this cause? You know, I mean, it might as well have been a Trump supporter painting that on the street. You know, it's so bad.
Well, this does seem to be the pattern. I think Noah Rothman's written about this, where Democrats come up with something like the Green New Deal or defund police. And then when you actually ask them or push back and say, well, this doesn't make any sense or the numbers don't add up, they go, well, OK, we weren't really serious about it. You misunderstand. This was really just this was a thought experiment we were engaging in. Well, you know, perhaps if you have a slogan that is prone to misunderstanding, that tells you something about your messaging issues.
I can tell you when I worked for Ted Cruz, when we said defund Obamacare, we meant defund Obamacare. That's right. What it meant. And the purpose of his slogan is that people understand easily what you mean. So if you screw that up in three words, you have to rethink it.
You have to rethink it. Amanda Carpenter, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. And we'll do this all over again.